Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a solartopia, solartopia, solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a solartopia all over that green world?
Well, we bit the apple and the garden was lost, so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
don't you know we're going to have a Solartopia? All right, that's the great Dar Williams with Pete Seeger and David Byrne singing the song for Solartopia. We are here now at the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. We're going to have Rex Weiler with us. Rex, are you there?
Here, Harvey. Glad to hear from you.
Glad to hear from you, Rex. You are out without power in the boonies of far northwestern Canada. Is that correct?
Yeah, we just had a big blow last night, so the power lines all went down. But I've got a telephone connection, so here we are.
Well, we like to hear that. That's great. And I envision you sitting in the dark with a candle like they all said we do after nuclear power went away. But you have nuclear power, and you're still sitting in the dark. I want to talk, Rex, if you'll be patient with me, I want to talk very quickly about some breaking developments. We may get a call or two, I'm not sure, at Vermont Yankee. Last week we talked in great detail about what's happening with this horrific nuclear power plant in the southeastern corner of Vermont at the border with Massachusetts and New Hampshire on the Connecticut River. The company Entergy, which owns a bunch of nuclear plants based in New Orleans, has gone around buying a nuclear plant. It bought Vermont Yankee 10 years ago, and or 9 actually, and is now trying to get a certificate of public good from the Public Service Board of New Hampshire to continue to operate. When Entergy bought Vermont Yankee, it agreed that if the state did not give it a certificate of public good in 2012, which is now, this week, it would shut down. It has reneged on that agreement. It's gone to federal court. And yesterday, the Public Service Board of New Hampshire issued a decision denying Entergy the certificate of public good, saying that Entergy does not have a valid state permit to continue to operate or to generate nuclear waste at the reactor in Vernon. Entergy has gone to federal court. It did get an injunction yesterday from Judge Murtha, Garvin Murtha, saying that they can't force the reactor to shut until the issue is decided by the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. That's the federal court. So what's happened now, Judge Murtha originally issued a decision, and I have a piece about this posted at nukefree.org, www.nukefree, nukefree.org, explaining the basics of the decision. Murtha ruled that the state legislature, which voted 26-4 to shut Vermont Yankee, could not do it because they had dared to discuss safety issues, which, according to Judge Murtha, are the province only of the federal government by virtue of the, or by lack of virtue of the Atomic Energy Act of 1954, which shut states out of the process of nuclear power. But today, as we said, or yesterday, the State Public Service Board said that the state, that Entergy does not have a state permit to continue to operate or to generate nuclear waste. Now, Vermont Yankee delivers virtually no power to the state of Vermont. It's an export operation, and so the state of Vermont is being used essentially as a base for a nuclear plant that it wants shut to provide power to other states and profits to Entergy. So where we stand now, it's all up in the air. Entergy does not have a valid state permit to continue to operate or to generate nuclear waste, but the federal court has intervened, and we will see what happens. Essentially, we're going to see if the federal government can force the state of Vermont to continue to allow Vermont Yankee to operate, even though the nuclear plant has no state permit to operate. It's a very, very amazing phenomenon. We may get some calls from people in Vermont. I will be posting a new piece tonight at nukefree.org, and we'll proceed from there. This is a huge issue because there are 104 rust bucket reactors operating around the United States and a bunch in Canada as well. And the question now is, as there are two other states at least, New Jersey and California, which and Indian Point in New York also, where the state is contemplating or has already imposed additional conditions for operation based on denial of state water permits. And this has already come to bear at Oyster Creek in New Jersey, where the state of New Jersey said to the owners of Oyster Creek that you are going to have to build a cooling tower because we can't sustain continued hot water emissions into the water bodies there. A deal was cut where rather than build a cooling tower, which is very expensive, the owners of Oyster Creek have agreed to shut in 7 years. Of course, in 7 years from now, obviously they'll go to court and try and force the state to renege, or themselves to renege. We see the state of New York, Governor Andrew Cuomo, which may impose the construction of cooling towers at Indian Point, which we don't think Entergy also owns Indian Point. We don't think they'll do it. And similar decisions are being forced at the four reactors in California, two at San Onofre and two at Diablo Canyon. San Onofre, both reactors are shut now, and so we're hoping that those will stay shut as well. But this is a hugely important issue at Vermont Yankee. The test will be whether a state can actually deny a permit to operate. I mean, the Entergy and the courts are going to have to say, look, you are required to give an operating permit. This is not a, you know, this is a double negative here. They're saying you are being denied, the state is wrongly denying the owner of Entergy a permit. Well, that's pretty amazing. So we actually have Richard Watts on the phone. Rex, I hope you don't mind being patient for a minute.
No problem. I'm enjoying hearing about this. I read the news about this. I understand that this is going on, and this is so typical.
We can talk about nuclear issues with Rex.
Go ahead, and I'm standing by.
Okay, well, Rex is a founder of Greenpeace International, a truly great figure in the environmental movement. I'm honored to have you on, Rex, and we'll talk about this. Richard Watts, is that you? Have you called in?
Yes.
Okay, now, Richard, you are author of a book. We'll get that up front here that's coming out today. What's the name of the book, and how can people get it?
It's called Public Meltdown, The Story of the Vermont Yankee Nuclear Power Plant, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, whatever you would do.
Okay, well, congratulations on having your publication today. Tell us what you know now about what's going on here with this breaking news of Vermont Yankee.
Well, I think you're right that it's an unusual case in that Entergy agreed back in 2002 when they bought the plant to state oversight. And twist was added in 2006 when the legislature said we should have a voice in this too. And that was the decision that allowed them to vote on it in 2010. At the time, they voted overwhelmingly to close the plant. The board, the Public Service Board, had not actually issued its ruling. Following that, Entergy won the 20-year license renewal from the NRC.
Yeah, a day before. That was on March 10th, 2011, a day before Fukushima melted down.
I know. The ironies are amazing. And
so 24 hours before Fukushima melts, Vermont Yankee gets an extended permit. Vermont Yankee is a Fukushima clone. Is that correct?
That's right. Same reactor.
So you would think maybe the NRC would say, whoa, this thing melted down or blew up. It actually blew up and melted down. The NRC said nothing. And, in fact, the chair of the NRC, Gregory Jasko, has complained that his other four commissioners, his four co-commissioners, have not implemented the lessons learned from Fukushima. But let's go on now with Vermont Yankee. What is happening today, and what are we seeing in terms of the legal ramifications here?
Okay, so, you know, again, just a couple quick catch-up to speed. So a month after the NRC issued its permit, Entergy filed a lawsuit saying that the Vermont did not have the right to, oversee the issues because they were really talking about safety. And a federal judge back in January at the district court level agreed with Entergy, and he said, and he did something really unusual, which is a big concern to the people following the case. He said that what the legislatures were talking about, he went through the entire legislative record, and that was Entergy's case, that the decision that the legislature made was based on this record rather than the actual wording of the law, which, of course, doesn't mention safety. The judge voided the law. But he did not. Entergy had asked for the state regulators also to be removed from the oversight process, but the judge reaffirmed the role of the state, the traditional role that the states have always had in regulating some of the non-safety issues. About a few weeks ago, Entergy appealed that part of the decision, and the state appealed the loss that they suffered in the district court. So both sides have appealed it, and it's now before the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. That will take
some
time to play out.
So you have simultaneously appeals, one from the state saying, yes, we do have the right, the legislature has the right to vote to shut Vermont Yankee, and the other from Entergy saying the legislature, not only does the legislature not have the right, but the Public Service Board doesn't have the right. Is that correct?
That's right. That's right.
So they're saying, Entergy is saying that the Public Service Board has to issue them a certificate of public good, whether they want to or not.
That's right. Or that they should be removed from the process altogether.
But this is something that Entergy agreed to 10 years ago.
Yeah, they signed an agreement and testified under oath committing to seek state, and this is what made Vermont unusual, to seek a state permit in the 20-year relicense renewal process.
Say that again.
So when Entergy signed, you know, everybody knew, you know, for the industry to survive, they need to do these 20-year renewals. Everybody knew when Entergy bought the plant that they would be seeking a renewal, a license renewal by 2012. At the time that Entergy bought the plant, they signed an agreement with the state saying that not only would they seek that permit with the NRC, they would also seek a permit from the state regulators.
But now they're saying that since the state regulators have decided not to give them a permit, they're going to federal court.
Yeah, I mean, a little nuance, but basically they're saying they don't want to go through the state process, right?
And now, are they arguing that the reason that the state licensing board, the state public service board, can't do this is because why?
Well, a lot of it comes back to the Atomic Energy Commission in 1954 and radiological issues and the preemption. And they're saying that Vermont changed the rules along the way. Yes, they agreed in 2002, but when the legislature started tinkering around with it, it voided some of those earlier agreements, and therefore they shouldn't have to go through this process.
Oh, for God's sakes. And are they doing this with a straight face, or are they wearing clown suits?
Yeah, you know, it's become an important issue, though, beyond, you know, obviously the decision on yes or no on this plan is important, but it's also an important issue because for 30 or 40 years, states have had a major role in decisions about the power plants within their borders for a variety of good reasons. And in this case now, it may be tested whether or not a state has a right to look at things like the economics, the water permit issues, the all those other issues that states have traditionally had some role in.
Okay. Rex, is this an old story for you? Rex Weirer, co-founder of Greenpeace, a longtime anti-nuclear activist. You've heard stuff like this before, yeah?
Yeah, I think this is very typical, and you see this all over the world. It's really the privatization of all of our public assets, public resources, natural assets, and an attempt to undermine and really eliminate local environmental labor and social input into the process of industrializing the planet and privatizing the planet. We experienced a very similar thing in British Columbia over the last few years when some large corporations, General Electric and others, came into the province and wanted to privatize 800, imagine this, 800 rivers in British Columbia were on the block to be sold, public assets sold to private companies.
Wait, they were going to sell the rivers?
What's that?
They were going to sell the rivers?
Well, sell the water rights on the rivers and essentially allow these companies to go in and create, you know, to rip up these rivers and put these hydro projects on all the rivers in order I'll tell you the story later about where this power is going to go. It's going to go up to the fracking fields, the gas fracking fields, so they can get the natural gas things.
I love this here. So they're going to wreck our rivers to create electricity, to wreck the land, which wrecks rivers in the again, to create more energy. Was there going to be any net energy gain from, wrecking the rivers and taking the power out of the rivers to do the fracking?
No, and it goes further than this, Harvey. They're going to send the gas from the frack fields. They're going to send that gas to the tar sands to melt the bitumen in the tar sands so they can get it into a pipeline and send it to tankers on the West Coast and send it to China. This is the level of desperation that the entire industrial machine is operating on. But the point is, what they did in British Columbia is they actually went in and overturned local laws, eliminating local regional districts from having any input into this process. They did the same thing they're trying to do to you in Vermont, is they come in and they try to eliminate any local, state, provincial, municipal, regional input. Their corporate vision of the planet is that they're just fine to run the planet from their offices in Hong Kong and New York City, and they don't need local communities getting in the way.
Matt, is that Richard? Does that sound familiar to you? Richard Watts.
You know, by the way, it's just a delight to be with both you guys, who I know have worked on these issues for so many years. You know, I'm a researcher. I stay within the research that I'm doing, and clearly in Vermont, the success that the advocates had was because there was a state decision process. You know, the NRC issued the permit, as we know, but the state legislature voted no. The state regulators may have voted no. They never got to voting it, but it was that open, participatory, transparent, state-level stuff that allowed the advocates some leverage.
Well, Rex, did anybody in Canada ever come up with any way to leverage local veto power?
Well, yeah, you have to rise up. I mean, you've seen this over the decades. I mean, people have to rise up and band together and boot their governments out or make a stand, because you have to fight them in the courts as well. We found that you kind of have to work at every level all the time. Because no level, you're not going to win at any single level. You can win a court case, and then 2 years later, you're right back into the middle of the same court case. So you have to keep fighting at the legal front. Meanwhile, you have to fight at the political front. But I would think it really comes down to, you have to stir up the public, and you have to have a public show of support and interest in these issues in order to hold these guys off. Because assure you that they have a bigger legal budget than you have.
Well, that's a given. So how do we win? I mean, how are we going to win in Vermont?
Well, I wish I had the formula.
Richard,
but
what do you think? Richard's there. Well, let's see if he's got an idea.
Well, it's just interesting in Vermont now. My whole book is about how did this thing go from something that people weren't paying that much attention to this, you know, really overwhelming legislative vote, 26-4. The governor is now dead set against it. The attorney general, of course, is representing the state. So I'm not sure how it's all going to play out. It's going to take a few years, but the leaders in the state are absolutely committed to trying to close the plant. And currently, Vermont gets, you know, starting tomorrow, we won't be getting any electricity from the plant.
Well, clarify that real quick. What do you mean?
Well, part of the deal when Entergy bought it was they offered low-cost electricity, a fairly good deal, to the state utilities. As the whole environment between the company and the major stakeholders in Vermont deteriorated, the electric utilities, who distribute the power, of course, to households and businesses, decided not to buy power. They were unable to reach an agreement with Entergy, and so currently, starting tomorrow, we'll have an operating nuclear power plant, but none of that electricity will be purchased or sold in Vermont.
So Vermont will officially become a nuclear colony.
It's interesting. I mean, we do buy, actually. Vermont Utilities went and bought nuclear power from somewhere else, Seabrook. But this power plant will be here, but no benefits. And that's the thing that obviously concerns the governor and others.
Okay. Now, Rex, you have characterized Canada in a recent email that you and I exchanged as become a petro colony. Does this sound familiar, what's happening in Vermont?
Yeah, what has happened in Canada is that about a decade ago, as the oil companies knew full well that that the oil production in the world was going to peak and that all the large oil fields in the world were in decline, they decided that they would come into Canada and dig up the tar sands in Alberta. And I don't know how much you or your listeners know about the tar sands, but this is a hydrocarbon that's really in the it's a thick tarry hydrocarbon that's mixed in with the dirt and rock and sand underneath a beautiful boreal forest, one of the last standing old stand boreal forests in the world, and they've gone in there with the largest, most giant machines in on the planet, and they've created the largest industrial extraction operation on Earth, turning prairie lakes into black sludge pits, causing a cancer spike in the region among the local community, destroying the boreal forest, all to dig this tar sands oil out. And when they decided to do that, of course, the oil companies, including PetroChina, Sinopec, the Chinese companies, as well as Shell Oil, Imperial, and the American companies, and BP, when they decided to come into Canada, they did all their usual dirty tricks. They took over governments. They bought newspapers. They bought media. They control the media. They've spun their story. They own the federal government of Canada right now. The current Prime Minister of Canada, Stephen Harper, is the son of an imperial oil executive from Alberta. They bought and sold him. They ran his campaign. So, yes, Canada is now a petrol state. One of the first things they did is starting to build more jails and stiffen penalties for protesting and all that kind of. It's all typical. It's like Nigeria. It's like Canada's being treated like any other resource colony in order to dig up the tar sands.
Okay.
Harvey, do you mind if I slip out? And I just want to really appreciate your...
Okay, Richard, thanks for being with us. Richard Watts, what's your name of your book again?
It's Public Meltdown, the story of the Vermont Yankee nuclear power plant.
And how people get it?
Amazon or Barnes & Noble or your local bookstore.
Okay, why don't you call us next week, and we'll see what's going on with Vermont Yankee in a week, all right? Just give us a quick update. And we're going to continue now with Rex Weiler, my longtime buddy from Greenpeace. Thank you, Richard Watts, for being with us. Rex, you've got a wide range of books, and you've been, of course, campaigning for decades on issues near and dear to all of our hearts. You live in Vancouver, is that correct?
Well, I live on Cortez Island, about 150 kilometers north of Vancouver.
And what's it like out there? It must be beautiful.
It's gorgeous. I'm sitting right here looking out my window at the lake and cedar trees and fir trees, and yeah, it's just gorgeous. I'm in the forest.
Huh. You grow firs out there. That's good. Better than having to take them from animals, right? Terrible pun. Okay. So we're going to take a break in a couple of minutes, but before we do, what are you working on now most importantly? And then we're going to get into energy stuff again and also the histories of Native America. You've got a history of Native America, which is extremely important to us, and we want to talk about Leonard Peltier in a minute. But what's your primary issue right now?
Well, right now we're working on trying to stop this tar sands development, particularly the pipelines and oil tankers on the West Coast. There's two companies, Enbridge, Kinder Morgan, are trying to build pipelines to the West Coast and really turn the West Coast of Canada into the tar sands shipping port. And the only
they want to avoid, is that in addition to the XL pipeline, or is that different?
In addition to the XL pipeline, they want all of these pipelines. They want the XL going down to Port Arthur, Texas. They want and these two pipelines coming west to ports in British Columbia.
Wow.
It's massive. And we're fighting. Well,
is it going to be enough to fill both pipelines?
Oh yeah, they need more pipelines. They given their projected 4 to 5 million barrel a day production, they need about 5 or 6 Keystone sized pipelines.
Oh my God! Well, how big is the hole they're going to dig in Alberta here? That sounds like going all the way to China.
Yeah, it's the largest industrial project on the planet. You can just Google it, the pictures, and just look at the pictures. There's some beautiful pictures by Garth Linz, the photographer Garth Linz, and there's also a very touching TED Talk given by Garth Linz with some of his images. So if you or any of your listeners want to see what's going on in the tar sands, just Google Garth Linz photos. And
well, how do you do that? G-A-R-T-H?
Garth, yeah, G-R-T-H Linz, L-E-N-Z.
Oh, L-E-N-Z, okay. If you'll email me the URL, I'll post it at nukefree.org.
Okay, I'll do that.
Okay, so that's the biggest issue now, and I assume Richard Harper, the petro-based PM of Canada now, is totally in the pocket of the oil company. Is that correct?
Yeah, Stephen Harper. Yeah, he's the oil company guy, bought and sold. They funded his election. They've been hyping him, made him leader of the Conservative Party. And then they did all the dirty tricks that they do in the U.S. when Bush stole the election. They did that up here. They intimidated voters.
You know what, Rex, let me interrupt you here at this pregnant moment. The music in the background tells us we're going to take a break.
Okay.
And we will be back with Rex Weyer. We're going to talk about tar sands, Native Americans, nuclear power, and the founding of Greenpeace when we return after this break. We are back. That's our mutual friend Dana Lyons, the great founder of Cows with Guns, and a friend of ours. Rex, you and Dana go way back too, don't you?
Yeah, I remember. Yeah.
So we were talking. We're talking with Rex Weyer, a founder, an actual founder, as opposed to Patrick Moore, of Greenpeace International, and a resident, a great activist in the Canadian Northwest. We've been talking about the tar sands that are going to be destroyed, that the tar sands that are prompting the major petrocorporations to dig a gargantuan gash in Alberta and wanting to run pipelines not only, and it's news to me, not only to Texas, the Keystone Pipeline, all the way across the western United States, but also through Vancouver to the Pacific. And you have been fighting that, Rex. You have now a petro dictator in Canada, Stephen Harper. What's the deal? How are you going to stop these guys?
We're going to make alliances with we've already made alliances with the Indigenous people of Canada, with the municipalities involved, and primarily support the people to rise up and protect their coastline. If we have oil tankers on the coast of British Columbia, we will have oil spills. You know something, Harvey, most of the oil spilled in the ocean, like 80% of the oil spilled in the ocean, comes from what they call normal spillage, normal operational spillage. Every city, every port that becomes an oil port has an ongoing perpetual oil spill going on in it. Then, of course, the risk of a large-scale Exxon Valdez scale or larger oil spill would haunt this region, and eventually would likely happen. So people are going to rise up in British Columbia. They already are. The First Nations, the Indigenous communities in British Columbia, 61 nations have signed. Indigenous nations have signed a declaration called the Fraser River Declaration, saying no tar sands development on our traditional territories. and there's a lot of money on the table. The companies are trying to buy off the indigenous communities, but it's not working. The indigenous communities are saying, keep your money. We want our rivers. We want our forests.
Well, great for them. Now, you have a book about Native Americans, the history of Native America. Tell us a bit about it, and tell us about the Native Americans, if you would.
Well,
and what's their importance here?
During the early days of Greenpeace, actually, Harvey, in 1976, I was in Vancouver working with Greenpeace at the time, and this was shortly after the U.S. federal agents invaded the Lakota community at Wounded Knee, and there was a shootout there, and they were chasing Leonard Peltier. And Leonard Peltier at that time actually came through Vancouver on his way to Alberta and actually stayed with friends of mine in Vancouver on his way to Alberta, and then was arrested in Alberta, turned in and arrested, and taken back to the U.S. for that horrible mock trial. So I started investigating that story. That's how I ended up writing that book. I started investigating the story of Leonard Peltier, and who was he, and what was the background. And it was like this, Harvey. I tried to get to the bottom of it. There's no bottom. It's a story with no bottom. It just goes on and on. The federal infiltration into the American Indian movement, murder, setting people up for crimes, creating false witnesses, getting witnesses to sign false statements against other people. There was this terrible story of the federal agents hauling this poor woman, Myrtle Poorbear, off to a hotel and harassing her and threatening her children and getting her to sign affidavits against Leonard Peltier. It's just one dirty trick, nasty story after another. So,
well, now Leonard Peltier is still in federal prison.
He's still in.
He's been there since what, 1979, 8? He's the longest standing political prisoner in the world, probably.
He's one of the longest running political prisoners in the world. I believe he was first incarcerated in 76, Harvey.
God, 76. So he's been in, what, 36 years now, correct?
Yeah.
9 years longer than Nelson Mandela. And he's never actually had a fair trial, correct?
No, he's never had a fair trial. That was the trial I was talking about with these false affidavits from Myrtle Poorbear. No, they just made up charges against Leonard and created witnesses out of thin air and threw him in jail, and he's still there 36 years later.
Do we have a website where people can go to work to try and get Leonard out?
There is a Leonard Peltier Defense Offense Committee. I don't have it on the tip of my tongue, but sure, you just Google Leonard Peltier.
That's P-E-L-T-I-E-R.
That's right.
And he's still in federal prison for a murder he never has had a fair trial over, right?
Yeah, and which he did not commit. I mean, he's an innocent guy who essentially was framed with this murder, framed by the FBI. Now, there's another young man from Canada in jail down there now, John Graham, who was also framed with the murder of Anna Mae Aquash, which is somebody we're pretty sure the FBI killed. In fact, we're pretty sure we know who did it, who pulled the trigger. But the FBI killed Anna Mae Aquash, and then they framed a Canadian Tushone indigenous man by the name of John Graham, who they hauled back to the U.S., and he's in prison down there as well.
And how long has he been in prison?
He's been in prison now for about 6 years.
So these are two Native American activists who have been falsely accused of murder and being held in U.S. jails. Leonard for more than 36 years, John Graham for 6 years. And what are the prospects of getting him out?
Well, I'm always hopeful, but, you know, we've been working on this to get Leonard out of jail for a long, long time. I remember when Jimmy Carter, going back to when Jimmy Carter was president of the United States, and when he was leaving office, Tom Campbell and myself and a couple others went to Washington, D.C. and camped out there for a month lobbying Congress and Jimmy Carter to get Leonard pardoned and out of jail. And it didn't work. We got lots of support there, but when push came to shove, I think Carter got the visit from the FBI, and for whatever reason, the FBI has taken this Leonard Peltier case very personally, and they have their whole they have a whole organization of ex FBI agents who monitor this thing, make sure that Leonard never gets out of jail.
I happen to know we have mutual friends who knew Bill Clinton, and they definitely lobbied him, and he knew everything about that issue. And Peter Matheson was one of them who's written In the Spirit of Crazy Horse about the case. And, you know, Clinton did pardon a bunch of reprobates from Wall Street, but couldn't bring himself to pardon Leonard Peltier or even to give him a new trial.
And well, so, yeah, and this is a huge disappointment in my mind with the sort of liberal establishment, people like Bill Clinton, and even going back to Jimmy Carter, who I otherwise had high regard for. And I feel the same way about Obama. I don't think there's any chance. I mean, it would be a great thing if Obama actually rose above this, but so far it doesn't look like he will. But yeah, this is a real concern of mine with the so-called liberal establishment is when it really comes down to it, they just don't appear to have the guts to do the right thing.
No, and you know, so Leonard Peltier continues to rot in prison. He's been a symbol of Native American rights and denial of them since 1976. And so, you know, every day I wake up feeling worse because Leonard Peltier is still in prison. He's got great grandchildren he's never seen.
Yeah, it's a sad story.
Horrible story, terrible.
It's a horrible story, but it's what goes on all over the world, Harvey, and you know, certainly ask the people in Sudan and Nigeria and so forth what happens when their nations get taken over by corporate control, and so I guess we shouldn't be surprised that it happens here.
No. And now, your book about Native American history, tell us a bit about your book and about what you conclude about Native Americans and their role
in
North American civilization.
And it's a story that goes back not just the Leonard Peltier case, but it's a story that really surveys the history of the relationship between the Europeans when they arrived in the Western Hemisphere and the indigenous people that live here. You know, I always thought it was an interesting irony, Harvey, that people in North America were so wound up about apartheid in South Africa. Oh, my God, how can you treat the black people of South Africa that way? And people, it never seemed to dawn on people that they had treated the indigenous people of this hemisphere in exactly an even worse way. And in fact, the apartheid system was fashioned after the way the U.S. treated the indigenous people in the Western Hemisphere. So my
right.
book really is called Blood of the Land. You can still find a few copies, used copies at Amazon and so forth. But it's really a survey of that relationship between the Europeans, Neo-Europeans coming to the Western Hemisphere and the indigenous people. And I feel this about it, Harvey. It's the big, dark, shadow, untold story of North America. It's America's shadow. It's the one thing that America has never come to grips with, is the fact that they stole these people's land, they made treaties, they abrogated the treaties, they cheated people, they murdered people, and now still going on today, keeping people like Leonard Peltier in prison. This is the big dark shadow for America, and I can tell you, I feel like historically, culturally, when nations do not deal with these moral and ethical issues, they just start to rot from the inside, and I think this is the fate of the United States if it doesn't deal with this issue.
And what can we do? What should the United States do about Native America and Canada's, for that matter?
What they should do is they should go back and they should honor all the treaties.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that's a no-brainer.
I teach some of this, so
if you make a treaty and you have any ethical soul at all, you keep the treaty.
Right. The United States government has made over 400 treaties with Native Americans and
broken all of them.
Broken every one of them.
Yeah.
Every single one of them. So there you go. So let's talk now, talking about Greek treaties. Let's talk a bit, Rex, about the founding of Greenpeace and Greenpeace's role today, and your neighbor, your beloved neighbor, Patrick Moore. You were present at the creation of Greenpeace, correct?
Yeah, I was involved with Greenpeace in the 1970s, and we created Greenpeace International in 1979 in Amsterdam, which is still going to this day. Greenpeace started in Vancouver, on the streets in Vancouver, just a bunch of ragtag Canadian environmentalists and people from the peace movement who came to Canada during the Vietnam War, started Greenpeace in Vancouver. I just spent a month, Harvey, I just spent a month in Amsterdam with Greenpeace International there. I was doing a project with them, archive project, and I have to say I was very, very impressed with the people in the Greenpeace office. I was blown away, actually, with the intelligent, smart, hardworking, bright, creative young people that they have working there. Greenpeace International really impressed me. They've got campaigns going on all over the world all the time. They're putting out news stories every single day. And they're monitoring so many issues, and I was really proud of them. I was proud of Greenpeace. I was proud of all the smart young people, and they work hard, and they work long hours, it was really heartening for me to see that it's doing so well.
Well, just by way of disclosure, I'm also senior advisor to Greenpeace. I'm paid a whopping dollar a year, which is probably more than I'm worth, but. Are you employed by Greenpeace at all, Rex, or just on contract basis?
From time to time, I do something officially with Greenpeace. Of course, I work with them in an informal way all the time on issues, but I do write a column for their international website. It's called Deep Green. So if your listeners Google my name, Rex Weiler, W-E-Y-L-E-R, and if you just Google Deep Green and Greenpeace, you'll find my my blog there. And so that's the one thing I do on a regular basis with Greenpeace is I file stories, and I write a lot about energy. I've got an article on there called Nuclear Delusions, which your listeners might be interested in which I talk about why nuclear is not an energy solution for us. I talk about the fact that it's not low carbon, as people claim, that the health factors are real, the corruption, the subsidies, nuclear waste, the weapons, and the sheer scale of what would have to be contemplated to replace any significant amount of hydrocarbons. But anyway, so that's the one thing I do with Greenpeace on a regular basis, is I write that column. And then I work very closely often with Greenpeace here in Canada on various campaigns, such as the tar sands campaign now.
Great. Okay. You and I had a little email. Well, let's talk real quickly then. There is a guy out there, Matt, Patrick Moore, who claims to be a founder of Greenpeace and who is basically shilling for the nuclear, not only nuclear power industry, but the clear-cutting timber issue industry, genetically modified foods. Now, he is your neighbor, is that correct?
Yeah, he lives in Vancouver. I've known Patrick for years. We call him the Judas of the environmental movement. Essentially, he sold out the movement. He takes money from the from Asian pulp and paper and nuclear companies and genetic engineering company. He'll take money from anybody and come on and promote their whatever their industrial vision is. He'll promote it, and then he'll just tag on that I was a founder of Greenpeace. It's just shameless shilling for these corporations, and so he's our Judas. I guess every movement has one or two.
Yeah, okay. And he's out there. He's a partner now with Christy Todd Whitman in some kind of pro-nuclear organization that turns up whenever they need to trot out somebody who's allegedly green to support nuclear power. So, Rex, you do some retreats at your island there. Can you tell us a bit about them?
Well, back in the 1980s, I was involved with I came to Cortez back in the 1980s and started a little organization here called Hollyhock, which is in which we've done seminars and workshops and developed kind of a community back to the land idea, although it's evolved over the years. But, you know, we have a beautiful garden and a greenhouse there. I don't run that operation anymore. There's a full staff there running it. But, we do seminars. I'm going to do one soon called Chop Wood, Carry Water, which we do a lot of work on the land, actually.
Is that like Tom Sawyer's fence when you get people up there and then you just put in the work?
Exactly. We get people up here and they come up for a beautiful holiday in the forest and we put them to work.
I like that.
That's better than having them out sitting around on lawn chairs somewhere and on the beach.
Espousing various highfalutin concepts.
Yeah. Yeah.
Beats working. Yeah, okay, great. And you've been doing this for a long time. How long have you lived out there?
Well, I lived on Cortez. I moved to Cortez, as I said, you know, in 1980-81. But I moved back to Vancouver for a while. I had kids in school, and we don't have a high school on Cortez. My kids were in school in Vancouver for a while. But I'm back on the island. I'm back on Cortez, and like I said, it's a beautiful day today.
Yeah. Well, I was on Saturna Island once near you, and that was really beautiful.
Oh, were you? Yeah. Well, you know this area then. I mean, it's just gorgeous up here, and I feel very fortunate. I live in the forest and on a beautiful lake, and my two boys went out fishing the other morning and brought back two beautiful cutthroat trout for lunch. So that makes up for...
Hi, all you listeners. You're agreeing with Emmy with Rex. Now Rex gives the bad news. What has happened to the government of Canada? Most of us here in the lower 48 think of Canada as this liberal bastion of national health care and gun control. What's really going on up there now?
Well, it was turned into a petrol state. It was taken over by the oil companies, and the government of Canada is now controlled by the oil companies. Stephen Harper's conservative government bought and sold, and they cheated, they lied, they stole an election, they did all the things they'll do in any petrol state in the world to get at the oil. So we're now really living in a resource colony in Canada, but the people are rising up and fighting it. But, you know, Harvey, that's just it goes on forever and ever. It's just never ending.
Well, how are you going to win? First of all, you say he stole the election. How did they do that?
Well, one of the things they did, they made massive phone calls, for example, to the conservatives made phone calls to the liberal regions of Canada, and they lied to people about the polling stations. They told them their polling station was in a new place. They essentially, you know, they just undermined the democratic process. And then on top of that, they virtually own the media in Canada. So all the media tends to support the oil company conservative candidates. They lied, they cheated, they stole, they promoted, they financed candidates. They just took over. They're very good at it. They, you know, they do it in nations all over the world.
Well, they did in Ohio.
Yeah.
So I guess we're familiar with what they've with the way they operate. And so, what about health care up there? Is that going to disappear?
No. Well, health care is one of those things that I think is pretty across the board in Canada. Everybody knows that health care is one of those things they're not going to touch, at least it's not going to be at the top of the agenda. And that's one great thing about Canada. We still have universal health care up here, and it's just a fantastic system, Harvey. It's just unbelievable. I mean, our family pays something like $120 a month or something, and that's it. We go in, if we need medical care, we go in and we're covered. If we have an accident, we go into the hospital, we're taken care of. My wife's recently had some serious back injuries and surgeries, completely taken care of. So we don't bankrupt our families because they have a health tragedy.
Well, that makes us a little envious. But I'm glad to hear that's still intact.
Yeah, that's
What about gun control? You still have gun control?
Yeah, but they're messing with that too, of course. They kind of want to bring in the American shoot 'em up mentality into Canada. So, but we're holding them off.
Okay, so now in terms of your continued activism, is there a powerful nonviolent movement in Canada that you think might be able to stop all this tar sands nonsense? And what do you need from activists in America to in the U.S. to make a difference here?
You shut down Keystone. You shut down Keystone. We'll shut down the Kinder Morgan pipeline to Vancouver. The First Nations, the Indigenous people, will shut down the pipeline to northern B.C., and we squeeze off the tar sands. That's how we win. So you guys do not give up on that Keystone. Do not let it happen.
Well, tell me specifically, and also the tar sands project itself, what is the environmental impact of it? What's it doing? How's it working? What's it doing to the environment there?
Well, environmental impact is first, they're destroying the boreal forest.
Boreal, B-O-R-E-A-L. Those are softwood forests?
Yeah, the northern forest.
Okay.
Boreal is the northern. They're destroying the northern forest. They're turning lakes up there. They're using lakes for sludge pits. So they're turning beautiful northern boreal lakes into black tar sludge pits. They're taking water from the Athabasca River and returning polluted water to the river. They're polluting the water table. They're bringing gas in from the northern fracking fields in BC. So they're having to frack the gas fields to send the gas to Alberta to melt the bitumen. So they're destroying and polluting the water table in BC to do that. And then they want to ship move the tar sands oil through pipelines, and they've already had massive pipeline spills. You may be aware of the recent pipeline spill in the Kalamazoo River in Michigan.
I haven't heard about that one.
Tar sands oil.
Tar sand oil from the tar sands.
That was oil from the tar sands going through Michigan, spilled in the Kalamazoo River. And this stuff, Harvey, this stuff is far worse than conventional crude oil. It creates a toxic cloud in the atmosphere. The heavy bitumen sinks. It smothers everything in water at the bottom of the water. It destroys the marine environment.
All right. Well, Rex Weiler, founder of Greenpeace, author of numerous books. Rex, what's the best place for people to track you down?
Check out the Deep Green column at Greenpeace, or just Google my name, Rex Weiler, W-E-Y-L-E-R. I've got various articles at Energy Bulletin and at the Deep Green column and so forth. It's easy to find me. If you come into B.C., drop in and visit.
All right. Well, we'll chop down trees and not chop down trees. We'll do yard work around your place and pretend we're at a seminar.
Yeah, okay.
Rex, a great guy, really a dear brother. Thank you so much for being with us. Founder of Greenpeace, author of numerous books, and we will take up your offer to stop the Keystone Pipeline and shut down the insane tar sands project in Canada. Thank you so much, Rex, for being with us. And
thank you, Harvey. Great work you're doing. Thank you for all the work you've done, Harvey.
Oh, it's been my pleasure, as you know. We are. This is another hour of the Soratopia Green Power and Wellness Show flying by. We'll keep you posted on Vermont Yankee. Check us out at the ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com website, and we'll see you again next week, Tuesday, from 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern Time.
Don't you know we're gonna have a solar-topia all over God's